Hi, this is R.C. Sproul inviting you to join me this coming summer for another breathtaking cruise to Alaska. This year, once again, we'll be going to Alaska from June 15 to June 22nd. And the subject I'll be lecturing on is Chosen by God. Now, some of you have already been with us on that voyage to Alaska, and you know really how spectacular that is. It's my favorite place to cruise. And in 08, we'll be going on another Holland American ship, the MS Westerdam, which will sail out of Seattle, Washington, and we'll be visiting Glacier Bay National Park. And if you've never been on that inside channel of Glacier Bay, you haven't seen anything yet. That is fantastic. And we'll be at Juneau, the capital of Alaska, the Sitka, Ketchikan, Victoria, British Columbia, and these ports of call. So if you're interested at all in planning a vacation with us in June of 08, where we'll be studying the doctrine of election together, for more information, give us a call at 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 1-800-435-4343, or visit us online at ligonier.org. That's ligonier.org, and they will give you all of the information of the different levels of cabins that are available and the various price structure. And if you sign up before the end of the year, you'll get a savings of $50 per person. So think about this. We'd love to have you and join us. You'll have a great time.
Can we objectively determine if our society is becoming decadent? Are things really getting worse? Stay tuned. Renewing Your Mind with Dr. R.C. Sproul is next. Welcome to this Monday edition of Renewing Your Mind with author, teacher, and theologian Dr. R.C. Sproul. Have you ever heard about the good old days when you didn't have to lock your door at night and a man's word meant something? People paid their taxes and nobody bothered anybody. Nowadays, the youth have no respect for their elders and nothing is sacred anymore, or so says the older generation. Are things any different from the old days? Do things really get worse with each succeeding generation? Today on Renewing Your Mind, we're beginning a series entitled Cultural Revolution. In today's lesson, Dr. Sproul will explain how the decline of culture is not the mere opinion of the older generation. Here's our teacher.
Several years ago, I had the opportunity to read an essay that gave a close analysis of the decay of the culture. And it talked about the radical change of the values of society, with particular emphasis on the change in the behavioral patterns of young people, where the difference from previous generations was stressed that the modern young person had become unruly, undisciplined, discourteous, and rude, and also great stress was made on the negative influence of popular music on the culture of the young people. And then as I got to the end of the essay, I realized that I had been tricked by the writer because he was reproducing an essay that had been written in the 4th century B.C. in Athens at a time after the Peloponnesian Wars, where there was a serious decline in Greek culture and society, and was articulating the kind of concern that was addressed at that period by Socrates and later by Plato. And the point then of the writer of this essay was this, that in virtually every generation, the older people have short memories of their own childhood and have a tendency to look at the current generation of young people and come to the conclusion precipitously that they're going to the dogs. And so they say that this tendency of older people to look at the current generation with a jaundiced eye and at their own childhood through rose-colored glasses, as it were, is typical of the so-called generation gap. But that essay ignores a couple of very important ideas. The one is that in history, in the history of civilization, there are notable periods of upheaval, and indeed at times catastrophic upheaval, in cultural and societal mores. Now, when I talk about mores, I'm not talking about morals. The word morals comes from the word mores, but what the term mores refers to are the observable patterns of behavior and the customs found in a given society at a given time. So what, as I say, the first thing that that essay ignored was that it is a matter of recorded and established history that cultures from time to time go through radical shifts in the customs and the behavioral patterns and the mores of their society. And so that we can't just rule out of hand the Socratic complaint in antiquity about a serious shift in the behavior of young people, and we can't assume that the analysis or the evaluation was simply done by a cranky old man looking at the modern youth. The second point that I think is overlooked in the essay I referred to is that there are certain patterns of behavior that do have objective measurements in a given culture. Statistical measurements, for example, of marriage and divorce rates and violence percentage rates and things like that that we see sociologists reporting on from time to time. To give you an illustration of what I'm talking about, a couple of illustrations, in fact, let me refer you, first of all, to an article I read recently that replicated a report by leaders in American public schools that was given and issued in the year 1940, in which the educators in America, in concert, polled the teachers and so on to find out what they perceived to be the most serious problems that they had to deal with in the school. The list that I'm about to give reflects the top 7 concerns that educators had with the behavior of students in 1940. Number 1 on the list was talking out of turn. Number 2 on the list was chewing gum. Number 3 was making noise. Number 4, running in the halls. Number 5, cutting in line. Number 6, violating the dress code. And number 7, littering. These were the 7 major problems isolated by the educators of behavioral patterns in the public schools in the year 1940. Now, in 1980, a similar poll was taken among educators in the public school system in America, and they were asked to identify and determine the most pressing problems that they had to deal with in the public school system. Number 1, drug abuse. Number 2, alcohol abuse. Number 3, pregnancy. Number 4, suicide. Number 5, rape. Number 6, robbery. Number 7, assault. Now, one doesn't have to be Pollyannish to understand that dramatic changes have taken place in the social fabric of the culture in which we live. And people are asking the question now, not only why can't Johnny read, or why can't Johnny write, or why can't Johnny think, or why can't Johnny pray, but it's why can't Johnny behave himself and not be engaged in these kinds of serious problems. We know that the culture has changed radically with respect to the intrusion of drug abuse. When I was a high school student, I recall vividly the scandal that was reported nationally when it was discovered that Robert Mitchum, who was then one of the main stars of the silver screen, had been arrested for possessing a marijuana cigarette in Hollywood. And people were shocked out of their minds that a visible person like a movie star would have indulged in a drug that had only been heard of in places of the worst pockets of crime in America. And when I was in high school, the human nature of boys was no different from what it is today, I'm convinced. But the things that kids experimented with in that period of American history after World War II were smoking and maybe tasting wine occasionally or something like that. But they didn't experiment with mind-altering drugs or with drugs that could become so addictive that led people into other forms of criminal activity, such as robbery and assault, because of their illegal character. And so the drug culture that has emerged in the last couple of decades in America has radically altered the landscape of our society, and particularly that societal subgroup of children. As we read increasingly of reports of children becoming engaged with these dangerous drugs in elementary school, even in primary school. And that is an observable, measurable, demonstrable change in the behavior patterns of the culture. I've mentioned in the past a study that was released in 1948 in a book written by Pattiram Sarokhan of Harvard University, where Sarokhan, as a sociologist and historian, sounded the alarm to the American people in 1948 of his concern for the destruction of the single most important element or unit of a stable society, namely the family. And what provoked Sorokin's alarming analysis in 1948 was the rapid rise of the divorce rate in America that had occurred between 1910 and 1945. In 1910, the statistically recorded divorce rate among American marriages and families was 10%. And it rose from 10% to 25% in that interim period between 1910 and 1945. And what Sorokin argued when he wrote his book in 1948 was that no society could survive and have the necessary stability to preserve civilization when the divorce rate of its population reached such a threatening high as 25%, indicating that one out of every four marriages was ending in dissolution, leaving a litter of broken homes. Now, of course, that was the concern in 1948. By 1980, that number had risen further to 40%. And as I'm speaking today, it has surpassed 50%. And with that radically accelerating divorce rate, spelling the disintegration of the American family, we come also to this side of the Cultural Revolution, where we see myriads of young people having lost confidence in the institution of marriage altogether and are opting to live with each other and to bear children with each other without the bond of marriage at all. And that has become an acceptable practice and a recognizable part of the mores of the culture in which we live. Not to mention the measurable increase in abortions and a host of other things, all of which demonstrate that things have indeed changed, and they've changed dramatically in the behavioral patterns of the culture. And when these statistics are evaluated and examined, some people get all upset and excited about it and immediately want to look for somebody to blame. And usually the first culprit that is blamed is the federal government or the movie industry or the press or the popular music industry. And certainly there's no doubt that each one of these estates of our culture have made their contribution to this cultural revolution. I remember last year watching a television commentary in which two death row inmates in America who were both 21 years old were interviewed on television, on camera, before they were to be executed, to give their own chronicle of how they got to death row. Now, we're talking now of a universe of two people, and you can hardly build a whole lot of scientific data on the basis of a universe of two. But what was striking about this particular interview was that both of these young men, who had been convicted of first-degree murder, had acted out murder as part of an initiation rite for a Satanist cult. And also what they had in common was that both of these young men, who were unrelated to each other and unknown to each other prior to the interview, had murdered their parents in order to gain entrance into this particular cult. And they were then interviewed and asked how they were attracted to the Satanist cult. Both young men, in this case, went back to their own personal histories and attributed their fascination with Satanism as having been triggered by their love for heavy metal music, and that they had been drawn into that worldview from the popular music that they were enjoying. I was thinking about that this morning when I turned on the television set. In fact, I didn't turn the television set on. I walked into a room, and the television set in that particular room was already on. And what I was watching was MTV, which is not a program that I would normally choose to watch. But I sat there and watched this, and I thought, we've come a long way from Leave It to Beaver, a long way from Happy Days, and even from the pop music of the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, as what I saw was orgiastic. It was an unbridled, sensuous demonstration, combining dance with music and so on. And this was just simply one more indicator of the way in which popular culture has changed dramatically. Well, I hear Christians all the time protesting about what has happened to so-called Christian America and what can we do about it. Well, I think the first thing we need to understand is that Christianity as a religion was never formally established as a state religion in America. Disestablishmentarianism was one of the articles that the Founding Fathers agreed on. It is certainly true that back in the 17th century, in the early settlements of America, that the leading group of settlers were devout Christians. But then people fled to this country from religious persecution in the 18th century. But in the 19th century, the country became a haven for people fleeing here for all kinds of reasons apart from religious persecution. The Irish came because of the potato famine, and others came for other economic reasons and economic opportunities, and so on. And America became a melting pot of views, of cultural mores, of customs, conventions, and so on. And it was by no means a monolithically Christian nation. However, the influence of Christianity was extremely powerful and widely felt. Again, if you look at the simple sociological structure of the oldest towns in America, you will see that the geographic structure of the town will display at the very center, physical center, geographical center of the village or of the town is always a church. Go to New England, go to any town in New England, and you will see that. Even in the community I grew up in, outside of Pittsburgh, if you would look at the geographical center of our community, there was the public school, and right next door was the community church. And the people who taught in the public school system during the day were singing in the choir and being deacons or whatever in the church on Sunday. Our music teacher at school was the choir director on Sunday morning. So you had this interplay between the church and the public school. And at that time, the school was operated not by the church. It was operated by a school board, and it functioned as a local body. It was not programmed by a federal government. It was much more in touch with the grassroots of the community in which the schools operated. All of that has changed. If you go to new communities, such as I live in Central Florida, it is rare indeed to find within the context of a planned community, physically, a church building of any kind, because the zoning regulations push the church to the perimeter outside in isolation of the local community. And there are reasons for that that I want to discuss in our next session. But for now, I want to say what is going on. I can't blame the federal government for what's happening in America, because the federal government tends to operate by polls. That is, we see that every day, that they're counting the noses of taking the polls all the time. What's the approval rate of the president or the Congress and so on? And in a very real sense, in any democratic society, the government will simply mirror and reflect the values, the virtues, and the customs that are already entrenched in the population, in the culture itself. And I don't think that God ever created the government in the first place to be the institution most responsible for creating public virtue. The institution that God created to have the greatest influence on shaping public virtue was the church. And so if we want to lay blame for the loss of American culture, we need to turn the guns on ourselves instead of trying to blame every other institution in every other state, even though certainly Hollywood has had a massive impact on public morality as well as popular music and all the rest. But that can only happen in an environment where virtues are up for grabs anyway. And again, I want to stress that I don't think that in the 30s and the 40s or in the 50s, America was a monolithically Christian nation. But the secular culture of that era in American history, in many ways, lived on the borrowed capital of the influence of historic Christianity. That there was a synthesis that had been established, a cooperation between the church and the secular community, where Christian virtues had clear visibility throughout the institutions of our nation, in the business world, in the press, in the political arena, and across the boards. And I think we have to understand that that situation no longer exists. And the Christian in today's America has to ask the same question that the expatriated Israelites asked during the Babylonian captivity: how can I sing the Lord's song in a strange and foreign land? That's the dilemma we face with the Cultural Revolution.
You're listening to Renewing Your Mind with Dr. R.C. Sproul. Today's message, The Decline of Culture, is part of a two-part series entitled Cultural Revolution. In this study, Dr. Sproul analyzes the rapid decline of American culture and exhorts the people of God to live faithfully in the midst of our fallen society. You can purchase the Cultural Revolution CD series for only $10. If you're a listener to Renewing Your Mind and you've never contacted us before, then we'd like to give you the two-part CD series Cultural Revolution free just for calling and telling us the call letters of the radio station where you heard this broadcast. Once again, the Cultural Revolution series is free to anyone contacting us for the first time. So call now. Our toll-free number is 1-800-435-4343. That number again is 1-800-435-4343. And for your library, we recommend a book written by Dr. Sproul entitled Life Views, written to help believers make a credible and effective stand for Christ in our culture. Life Views catalogs the major philosophies that compete with Christianity, tracing the origins of life views such as secularism, existentialism, pragmatism, and hedonism. The book Life Views is available for $15. To order any of the resources mentioned or to make a donation, simply call 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 1-800-435-4343. Or if you prefer, you can log on to our website at ligonier.org. That's ligonier.org. Did you know that you can get even more great teaching like you heard today by visiting our new website? When you visit Ligonier.org, you can listen, watch, and read the teaching of Dr. R.C. Sproul and many others. Our new media center combines daily Renewing Your Mind television and radio broadcasts with regularly updated articles. When you visit the site, be sure to sign up for our monthly e-newsletter, which includes links to even more biblical instruction from Dr. Sproul and updates about our mission at Ligonier Ministries. You can also get biblical answers to difficult questions from Dr. Sproul in our new Questions Answered section. Plus, browse thousands of resources in our store with new navigation features. Visit the new website today at Ligonier.org. That's spelled Ligonier.org. That'll bring a close to this Monday edition of Renewing Your Mind. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us tomorrow as Dr. Sproul teaches us what revival and reformation can do in our culture. Renewing Your Mind is a listener-supported radio outreach of Ligonier Ministries with Dr. R.C. Sproul.